It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Much to my dismay, the words today from actual epidemiologists, not the cereal box variety, but people who actually spent their lives studying all of the viruses and the spread and all that stuff. Today, the big news report, we may never reach herd immunity. COVID is going to, the best I guess we can hope for is that it turns from a societal disruptor, their words, to a regular infectious disease. So it's not going to kill you, hopefully, just going to make you really sick. But the vulnerable populations, the people who were never going to do well in this, trouble for them. Now, the cause that they gave for us not being able to reach herd immunity and to eradicate this was something called, something clever, and I always love good soft language, vaccine hesitancy. That almost sounds, you know, cerebral. It almost sounds, well, you know, there's good reason to be a little hesitant. Look, vaccine hesitancy is you're just wrong. You're not hesitant. You're just a moron. That's the easiest I can put it. Imagine deciding that we're not going to eradicate polio or smallpox. No, we can have a little polio. A little polio won't hurt you. You know, I used to push back. I used to push back at the label that my grandfather's generation and my grandmother's generation were given, and that is the greatest generation. I used to push back on it. And the reason I used to push back on it is I said, you know, my belief has always been, until now, of course, I've completely, over the last year, have changed my mind on this. But my mindset was always that every generation rises to the challenges before them. Because what choice do you have? You have to rise to the challenge. You have to take it on. You have to fight back. You have to do what you got to do to get through and to get to the other side. Used to be my belief. You know, my grandfather's generation wasn't any better or any worse than any other generation through history. Because, you know, I go back to 9/11. You know, after 9/11, you had, you know, thousands of young men and women, you know, flocking to the military and signing up going, we're going to go get them. Just like my grandparents' generation did. Obviously to a smaller extent, but like my grandparents' generation did in mass. Everyone joined up. All the men joined up for the military. All the women went into the factories. We turned this country into a massive wartime production machine. Everybody was on the same page. Everybody was going in the same direction. And, you know, same thing with the polio vaccine. It was a mass mobilization. And we didn't have... I guess we didn't have Facebook back then. We didn't have the kind of social media. So maybe you had the vaccine hesitancy people. Maybe you had them back then. But we got to the point where polio's gone. You don't hear people getting polio. You don't hear the smallpox coming back and killing people, because that generation rose to the occasion, rose to the challenge of their moment, and did something about it. And now I'm thinking back going, wow, no more great generations. The weird thing is we can't even identify what the problem is. Our lack of being able to see it and agree on it, no way we're going to be able to fix it. The polling numbers are just staggering of the number of people who go, I'm not getting the vaccine because, you know, Bill Gates is going to put something in there and track me. It's not safe. Now, look, there may be some people who have conditions that preclude them from taking it. And those people we have to help and deal with. But that's not every Tom, Dick, and Harry or Billy Joe, Bob, and Karen. get the damn vaccine. It's not that hard. I mean, this isn't that. But here's this moment. So the doctors are saying we don't have, we're not going to reach herd immunity. We're not going to do away with it. That and we've just screwed this up so badly that the variant that is much more contagious is just gonna be with us, because again, we had mask hesitancy. Again, not because we were actually hesitant, just because we were stupid, or some of us were. And even in this moment, you've got people flaunting other people's health. We're going to have no mask shopping parties. And you go, there are people who love being stupid. I don't know what it is. It's just one of those things where you go, I just love to show my dumbness. And this is one of those moments where you look at the complexity of problems, and we are not the society to solve those. Or at least it doesn't seem, the mass of us. It's crazy that there are so many people who are so over misinformed. And I hear people, do your research. And I'm stealing Trey Crowder's line of, watching YouTube with your mouth open ain't research. Something that you saw on the internet that Billy Joe Bob, typed out in bad English is not research. And the thing is, this is bigger even than just the virus and the vaccine. There's this old saying, see the elephant, that you can step back far enough that you see the entire elephant. You see all the parts of it. You see all the problems. You see all kinds of things. That's how you come to the solution. Sadly, too many people have their heads up the elephant's behind. And that's all they see. So, of course, we're not going to be able to fix our problems. Of course, we're not going to be able to come to solutions when all we have are people who want to be angry, who want to be outraged, and want to blame someone. So over the weekend, I got a bunch of emails from people who go, you don't seem to know the white working class. They left the Democratic Party because Bill Clinton. And I'm going, if that's what your thought is, again, head up the elephant's behind. Because it's much bigger than that. It's much more complex than that. It takes much more thought and input than just going, it's Bill Clinton's fault. It was decades in the making. Supply-side voodoo Reaganomics was something that brought us an entire new ideology of economic thought. That if we give rich people everything, we give corporate America whatever they want, the rivers of gold and honey will flow upon us, and corporate America will take care of us. That hasn't happened. So last week when I was talking about Joe Biden's speech and how I view it as kind of a reset back to my grandparents' generation of thought on ensuring that working people get decent wages, ensuring that working people have opportunity. In fact, as Biden pointed out in his jobs plan, 90% of the jobs that he's going to create don't require a college degree. It requires people with a strong back, a good mind, and able to work with your hands. Things that we used to do in this country, things that we used to respect, things that we used to encourage. And you go that Reagan era forward where, no, we're not going to do that dirty, menial, manual labor stuff. No. And it's because of the economists of the time, people like Milton Friedman, who tried to convince us that we didn't need to do dirty manufacturing or those low-class jobs. We could poor people in poor countries to do that. We could all sit in the corner office and we can all wear our suits and our ties and drink lattes or whatever. And it was going to be great. Everyone gets a corner office. Problem is, only the CEO got the corner office. And the rest of us got stagnant wages, declining health benefits, retirement security that's all but gone, and less safe workplaces. Broken families, broken societies, poverty wages for most working people. And you wonder, okay, who do we blame? Well, we'll blame Bill Clinton. Reality, if you listen to the show, not a Bill Clinton fan. So saying that, Bill Clinton's the reason, he's part of the reason. He and the rest of them. This isn't just a one-off. Because, again, I go back to, if you think everything begins and ends with Bill Clinton, you're a moron. and you've got your head up the elephant's behind. The fact that Amazon, their quarterly profits tripled during the lockdown and the pandemic, and we didn't tax the heck out of them to help fund people to be able to stay home and stay safe, is just mind-blowing to me. And again, I go back to my grandparents' generation. Their tax rate for the vast majority of my grandfather's working life, who was a truck driver, and Milton Friedman and his ilk would have hated, was 92% on the 1%. If you had an income in 1953 of $1.6 million, on that dollar over $1.6 million in today's dollars, you would have paid 92% tax on. And we're screeching about 39%? Corporate America was paying 56% on their profits in corporate taxes. Today, we're screeching about return, taking it up to 28%. Again, not seeing the real problems. Now, my grandparents' generation, they fought wars. They fought polio. They fought smallpox. They built the most impressive infrastructure the globe had seen to that point. Did incredible things, built the most prosperous working class in the history of civilization. And Biden wants to return us to those kind of ideals. The idea of reward for work, the idea that work is valued and should be compensated as such, so that we can have a broad, prosperous working class. And I know everyone loves to say the middle class. I'm talking about people who get their hands dirty. People who have to come home at the end of a long day and take a shower when they get off work. The people who their backs hurt at the end of the day. Those are the people that I'm concerned with. Our wealth class, they got tons of mouthpieces and tons of people worried about them. I'm not. I'm worried about people like my grandparents who struggled for years to support their family. And we're in this moment where I'm hoping. And look, you know, this is one of those moments where, you know, I don't take any joy in calling people a moron. But if you're not getting the vaccine, if you're giving me simple, simplistic, idiotic lines, well, Bill Clinton signed NAFTA. Well, that's true. But for those who don't know, NAFTA was birthed under the Reagan administration, fully negotiated during the H.W. Bush years, and signed partially into law by H.W. Bush. And it was going to happen if H.W. Bush won again in 92, regardless. Clinton did come in, make some minor toothless tweaks to the labor and environmental parts of it. Not enough to make me at all happy. And he signed it because that's where corporate America wanted us to go. And for me, the Democratic Party had walked kind of away from labor years before that. The difference is, and the reason that I'm a Democrat still, is because, well, working people have one last best hope, and that's moving the Democratic Party back to where they were when my grandparents' generation were in power, back when they were still roaming the earth. Because the Republican Party to this point has been the party of destroying workers and their ability to join and form unions. You look at Taft-Hartley, you look at all of the attacks on the National Labor Relations Act. You look at the fact that they've rammed through right-to-work laws in states across the country the second they get power. And they will do it here in Pennsylvania if a Republican is elected governor in 2022. There is no question about that. So to throw at me, well, you know, Bill Clinton, not a Bill Clinton fan. So one of two things you're showing me. One, you don't listen. Because I've been saying this for years, or two, you're just a moron. And again, I say I don't take any joy in that, because the more divided we are, the more difficult these complex problems become to solve. And we need to solve them. We can be the greatest generation. This can be the greatest moment in the history of this country. This can be an opportunity for us to come together and go, you know what? We do want those common things. We do want, you know, safe neighborhoods for our families, good jobs for our workers, good schools for our kids, opportunity, opportunity, opportunity. We could rebuild and give our children a future that well, we only imagined when we were younger. But we're not going to do it. Why? Because we have vaccine hesitancy. Why? Because we've been so pitted against one another. We've been so put into our little boxes and subdivided and sliced and diced that all we want to do is bicker and blame, not solve. And I keep saying, look, I can get past the partisan divide. I want to get things done. It's not about scoring points. It's not about gotcha. It's not about my argument beat your argument. It's about how do we ensure that the working people I look in the eye every day who are just trying to put food on the table actually get to do that? How do we pursue policy that's going to move us forward and do it in a way that everyone comes along? Kind of like our grandparents' generation did. Kind of like that greatest generation. How do we rise to the challenges of today when there are entire industries, right-wing talk radio, cable news, who are out there and make their profit and make their bones off of just ticking us off and not critically thinking about how we move past all this stuff, how we fix the problems, of which we have many. And how do we heal those divides? I see these polls all the time. Well, you know, Joe Biden isn't united the country. He's been in office 102 days now. It doesn't happen overnight, and it's not his responsibility to do. It's ours. So if I can do one thing, there's a way that we can begin to come together. Get the vaccine. Help us reach herd immunity so this doesn't take lives in the future. And in the future, don't send me emails simplistically blaming Bill Clinton for everything, because he was only a small, small part of the problem. Much bigger. Corporate America is our problem. That's who we need to take on. I'd love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. I do appreciate the emails and answer them myself. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Jeff Hauser is going to be here to share some thoughts on, well, evidently he's part of a well-funded think tank team. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
There's nothing more American than workers standing up, and the union gives a voice to win.
On The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1911. That was the day the state of Wisconsin passed the Wisconsin Workmen's Compensation Act. The state became the first to have a constitutional system for providing medical expenses, wage loss payments, or death benefits to employees or their families. The law is regarded as a pioneering act of social legislation and a major accomplishment of Wisconsin's progressive movement. Activist journalism exposed deadly and disfiguring working conditions in the country's industries. State industrial commissions were established to conduct factory inspections and demand reform legislation and regulations. Upton Sinclair's initial intent in writing The Jungle was to cultivate a public outcry for better and safer working conditions. By 1907, the Russell Sage Foundation funded dozens of investigators to study industrial and social conditions in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Two volumes of essays were produced, entitled The Pittsburgh District, Civil Frontage, and Wage Earning Pittsburgh. The essay, Work Accidents and the Law, written by Crystal Eastman, exposed the enormity of work-related accidents and deaths and the failure of employers to compensate victims and their families. Her investigation examined several industries, including railroads, steel, and coal mining. She noted, quote, "There is no bright side to this situation. By industrial accidents, Allegheny County loses more than 500 workmen every year, of whom nearly half are American-born. 70% are workmen of skill and training, and 60% have not yet reached the prime of their working life. Youth, skill, strength, in a word, human power is what we are losing." Eastman's survey worked to shift the burden from workers to employers. It is largely credited with the passage of workers' compensation laws, though it would take decades for similar laws to be enacted in states throughout the nation.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So some good news ABC News Ipsos poll just out on Sunday. 64% of us optimistic. Things are heading in the right direction. It hasn't been that high since 2006 when 61% of us said, yeah, pretty optimistic. Economy's going kind of well. Things haven't collapsed yet. We're coming out of this pandemic. There's some hope, maybe, even though we're probably not going to reach herd immunity because of the idiots who are vaccine hesitant. Again, just code for stupid. But look, this level of optimism, I think as long as we keep moving in the right direction, Biden keeps doing the work, I think we're heading in the right direction. And color me one of those folks who is optimistic for the next 3.5 years. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on, well, the big speech. I've asked our good friend Jeff Hauser. He's the executive director of the Revolving Door Project at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Jeff, thanks for taking time for us.
Anytime, Rick.
So I saw something today over at the New York Post. I hear you and your well-funded, influential left-wing think tank there at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. I hear you got the air of Elizabeth Warren, AOC, the squad. I hear you got them on speed dial.
Absolutely, because that's how we roll. We only have the occasional mouse and the... only one of our staffers had a hole in the roof above her to be occasionally rained upon. So Revolving Door Project, what we try to do is make the executive branch better. And that often involves scrutinizing potential and actual picks for executive branch jobs. And so we focused on a woman who has a very obscure but very powerful position. She was named by the chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission, Gary Gensler, to run the enforcement division of the SEC. This is basically being the top cop on Wall Street. Like, people think of that as the chair of the SEC, but it's really the director of enforcement under the chair who has that very powerful position to determine if our stock market is going to be built up on fraud. And obviously that's a risk. We all lived through the financial crisis in 2008. We know that we need a good SEC. The person Gensler put forward, for reasons that still remain to be determined, is somebody who spent basically her adult life trying to get corporations out of trouble. In fact, her top client was ExxonMobil. And so we raised opposition to her. And within less than a week, it came out that a Reagan-appointed district court judge found her behavior to be worrisome in a case being brought on behalf of Indonesian villagers whose village had been rampaged by goons hired by ExxonMobil to prevent protests in Indonesia. And Alex O, the woman in question, she went so over the top that a Reagan-appointed judge found her conduct problematic. So due to our efforts and our allies like Demand Progress and the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, we had raised the red flags, and Gary Gensler, who had previously been supported by people like Elizabeth Warren, got the message, and Alex O was out 6 days after she joined the SEC. Now, this made a lot of people on Wall Street pretty upset because they had a big law Wall Street lawyer in this key position. And so they had their friend at Fox Business News, who also writes for the New York Post, this guy Charles Gasparino. They tried to ship him some oppo on Revolving Door Project, which is ironic because what we do is opposition research on corporate funded people who want to get jobs in the executive branch. And so their opposition research on the Revolving Door Project is that we're apparently well funded and influential. And we like to think that we are influential, even if we don't necessarily speed dial with AOC. Not that we would be opposed to that, but that's not what we do. And the idea that we're telling Elizabeth Warren what to think is a little ludicrous. But regardless, we do like to think we're influential. But I can assure you that we are not that well funded. We're not well funded at all. And probably we're guessing our entire budget is somewhere between a third and one fourth of what Alex O made per year at Paul Weiss. So like all of us combined, that's our best guess. We'd love to see, we actually requested her personal financial disclosure. Me and my team of plucky young researchers We apparently bat above our funding level.
No, and look, you guys do great work, and I think it's important that we know who sits in these positions of power. And if this is the case, we can find somebody else. We don't have to have a corporate lawyer for Exxon sitting on this powerful in this powerful position. There are other people, and I don't see a problem with this. But again, you know, this guy went to the old. You're just part of the leftist cancel culture, and you're taking your pound of flesh.
Yes. It's just so bizarre that, like, this is considered to be, like, if this is cancel culture, I think the American people would be very much in favor of it. The idea, I think the American people don't believe that big law firm partners who represent ExxonMobil and Bank of America and all the other clients that she had, I don't think people think like people like that are entitled to senior jobs in the government. In fact, I think quite the opposite. It's not cancel culture to call people out on the facts and identify who people have been working for in the past and who they might work for in the future.
Yeah, it's accountability culture. We want people who are accountable for their actions. And look, you know, this takes me back to, you know, where my thought today started off is that, you know, I go back to my grandparents' generation, the greatest generation, and I'm looking at, you know, the fact that, you know, we look at these problems so politically and so polarized instead of how do we get something done? How do we get something accomplished? Because I would argue, you know, people like this in these positions are exactly how we got into the mess that we're in. Corporate America writing our laws, having all the power in the halls, in our halls of power, and influencing all of the legislation. You know, someone sent me an email, and I can't verify it, but she said, you know, like 80% of legislation that corporate America wants goes through. Like 80% of legislation that we the people want never get to see the light of day. And you know, while the numbers may be off, the sentiment seems to be spot on.
No, there's definitely been political science research, maybe not exactly along those numbers, although they could be largely right, but that shows that unfortunately, what is popular is not generally a very good predictor of what Congress does or does not pass over to the president for his or her signature. It's just not that connected. It should be, and it used to be in the past. And I think, you know, Biden's doing a pretty good job of trying to take very logical, common sense positions that are overwhelmingly popular and trying to push it through. And sometimes it's working, and other times, you know, Joe Manchin says, you know, the book bipartisanship isn't met. But I think Biden's intuition that the bipartisanship that matters is that of voters, not of Republican elected officials, makes sense. And it's consistent with what I think is a justified populist moment of skepticism of leaders. We should be skeptical that the Republicans in Washington are representing Republicans. And as you said, like, I'm going to steal your accountability culture line, but our job is to, like, call it how we see it about whether or not Democrats are doing a good job of representing their constituents. We should be questioning all elites. Like, that's what it means to be a free person. Liberty, freedom, American values are questioning powerful people. That doesn't mean they're always wrong, but it certainly doesn't mean that they're always right.
Exactly. And this is one of the things, you know, we've been having you on the program for years now, and you're consistent. You don't care which party it is, whoever they put in, we're gonna make sure they're the best person for that. And I've always given you credit for that.
Sorry, my computer had a brief background moment going on. I mean, we definitely are willing to take on Democrats. And I think that that kind of approach is actually a way for politicians in purple districts to move forward and gain support. I think people don't like polarization. They don't like partisanship. But that doesn't mean they want some least common denominator, bland policy prescriptions that can achieve a consensus among the broken institution that is the U.S. Senate. It means that they want their interests represented. And I think that if given politicians can suggest that they are independent of their party and being willing to be critical of members of their party at times, because no one's perfect, we're all subject to criticism, then I think that they can move forward. And so I think that we should all be looking for opportunities to be bipartisan, but we shouldn't allow Mitch McConnell and his goons to determine whether or not we succeed.
I agree with you. Now, looking at Joe Biden's speech, what was, I guess, normally a State of the Union or State of the, you know, whatever we're going to call this, I thought it was a really good speech. I personally wish he'd have done about half of it. Then it would have been, in my view, an amazing speech. But it did go on a little bit. But I look at it, and what it was for me is kind of a reset back to, again, my grandparents' era and how government used to interact with workers and the economy and the working class. And for me, you know, it's not radical to want to return to a time that was really good for workers. Yet all the right wing commentaries, oh, this is socialism. It's radical. And I'm not seeing it as such.
No, it's a series of very commonsensical, basic ideas about giving people a leg up, giving people a lift. It's very American. It's very popular. It was a bipartisan consensus back in the 1950s. Dwight David Eisenhower got elected. He didn't take on Social Security. He didn't oppose unions. He, in fact, supported them. He supported antitrust laws. He didn't want a rapacious corporate class. He, in fact, left office excoriating the military industrial complex. And that was Dwight David Eisenhower. That was the Republican president. Our politics were more mixed and matched because obviously there were also, you know, Southern Democrats at the time who had abhorrent views on race. And there were some, the Republican Party had some better elements and some crazy elements. And the Democratic Party was mixed the same. But what everyone agreed upon was that the government had a role to play to make sure that the rich didn't take advantage of everyone else in the economy, and recognizing that we live in a society, which means that we have common interests and that we should help the people who are doing least well amongst us do better. I mean, what we teach our son is to think about things as not rich and poor, but lucky and unlucky. And I think that attitude was more common in the sort of elite conversation back in the 50s and 60s, this notion that you were not a better or worse person based off of where you or your parents went to school or how much money they had. And like that was an environment in which you had to prove yourself. There was skepticism if you were born into a rich family. And I think we need to come back to that era of viewing people as lucky rather than better. And I think that the American people are ready for it. I think Joe Biden embodies that sort of skepticism. And we're hopeful that on policies going forward, he continues to listen to that populist voice in his head and doesn't give in to the Larry Summers of the world.
No, I'm right there with you. My favorite Eisenhower quote, one of the things I loved about, he said, should any political party attempt to abolish Social Security, unemployment insurance, and eliminate labor laws and farm programs, you would not hear of that party again in our political history. There is a tiny splinter group, of course, that believes you can do these things. Among them are a few Texas oil millionaires and an occasional politician or businessman from other areas. Their number is negligible and they are stupid. The sad reality is stupid has been running the Republican Party for a very, very long time. So when Biden starts saying, hey, we want to go back to this, it is viewed as extreme and radical. And this is why I think it's so important that we push back on that frame.
Absolutely. And I think it is, we shouldn't underestimate the difficulty of the task that Biden has set out for him, because their polarization is not fake. There definitely is a sense in which people have a team and they root for their team in the same way they root for a professional sports team. And that means that Biden is probably never going to be as popular as his agenda. But we shouldn't go to the other extreme, which I think some kind of pundits like to go to, which is to assume that everyone is unchangeable. So I think the reality is that good governance and popular policies can chip away slowly and erode that partisanship. It's not like I'm saying, hey, if Biden does what I think he should do, he will win re-election or pass off the election to his vice president or something with like 65% of the vote in 2024. No, that is not, the upside is not that great in such a short period of time. But the need isn't to get to as popular as his agenda, which is anywhere between like 65 and 75% approval. The goal is you got 51% last time, try to get up to like 53, 55%, and then you can overcome disadvantages in the Electoral College, gerrymandering, redistricting, and the like, gain a few points here and there, and all of a sudden you could really be in business as a political party. And then over time, you hope to penetrate further.
The goal is chipping away. I don't think FDR got 65% of the vote, and his policies were very popular and did build the most prosperous working class in history and left an incredible legacy for Democrats. But again, you didn't have that kind of unity, but it still across the board benefited no matter who they voted for. And that's my thing. You got to make people's lives better. You want a chance at being reelected? You got to do the work at making people's lives better, not scoring and winning cheap political points.
Yeah. And you need to also be clear about drawing that connection for people to make sure they understand what it is that you are doing, what the connection is. And I also think you need to call out who the other side is actually caping for. Like the Republicans, they're representing some very problematic corporate interests. That is their genuine base. That's not what they like to talk about. They like to do culture war and then do the corporate tax breaks protection on the lowdown. And I think Democrats have to call out the game. They have to call out, they want you to think about the border so that you don't think about their economic agenda. We need to be calling it out specifically. And again, not because you're going to persuade everyone. There's no one perfect TV ad, one perfect speech to give, one perfect bill to draft to pass. But the more we are talking about what is actually going on and what the stakes are, and the more we're willing to lose some fights so that we can point to, this is how it can get better. If you, if in Pennsylvania, if we don't elect Pat Toomey's chosen successor, you need to create some real understandable stakes for voters.
Absolutely. I'm right there with you. Jeff, I appreciate the time. I appreciate the work you guys do. Great stuff. Keep it up. I hope you'll come back and talk to us again real soon.
Definitely will. Thanks for having me.
Good stuff. Jeff Hauser, Executive Director of the Revolving Door Project there at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Make sure you check out their website, therevolvingdoorproject.org. We'll get links out. Quick break, right back. Stick around and listen to The Rick Smith Show.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1919. That was the birthday of folk musician Pete Seeger. Seeger and his music would become staples of the U.S. labor movement. He was born into a musical family. His father was a scholar of musicology, and his mother was a concert violinist. During the 1940s, Pete Seeger joined with folk music legend Woody Guthrie to form the Almanac Singers. The band traveled the country supporting the Congress of Industrial Organizations. At picket lines, union meetings, and workers' rallies, Pete Seeger was there providing the music for the movement. In the 1950s, Seeger became the target of the anti-communist hysteria that swept the nation. He was blacklisted, shows were canceled, he lost a recording contract. Yet despite this repression, Seeger kept singing the songs of working people and standing up for justice. During the 1960s, the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement, and the environmental movement all marched to Pete Seeger tunes. When Seeger died at the age of 94, labor leader Jen Fuentes reflected on the impact of his music in an article in USA Today. She said, "These songs are what allowed workers to sustain themselves during times of adversity. He's a legend in the labor movement for his folk music that has spoken to the labor struggles throughout the year."
Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? They say in Harlan County there are no neutrals there. You'll either be a Union man.
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and the Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
Which side are you on?
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So a lot of talk around the filibuster, a lot of talk about doing away with it on the progressive side, you know, claiming it, you know, harkens back to Jim Crow, which I can't argue that it doesn't so much. But there are those who are saying, look, you know, we need to keep it because, you know, Republicans will maybe someday be in power. We may need it to stop their horrible things. Lots of interesting discussions on both sides, and here to share some thoughts on his most recent piece over at the Washington Monthly, Where Are the Filibusters?, written by Bill Scheer, contributing editor there at Political Magazine, also there at the Washington Monthly. He also does the fabulous podcast, When America Worked, and the DMZ. Bill, thanks for taking time for us.
Always great to talk to you.
So it's an interesting question. I got to be honest. I read your piece, and my thought was, yeah, where are the filibusters? Is the threat of them just enough to not move any legislation? Walk me through it.
Well, I say a lot of folks assumed we'd be in, you know, mortal combat already in the Senate. And I mean, just look at the 100 days. I mean, wherever you stand on the filibuster question, like, these are just the plain facts. 100 days of the Biden administration, 13 bills have passed the Senate. Biden signed 10 of them. I think the other three are going to come to his desk soon enough once they get through the House. And, you know, obviously, American Rescue Plan was by reconciliation. That was not bipartisan. There's also one other. There's a Congressional Review Act. That's a repeal of a Trump dereg thing that was technically bipartisan but didn't get the 60 they didn't need to. All the other stuff is bipartisan. McConnell voted for it. It includes a $35 billion water infrastructure bill that passed last week. Anti-hate crimes legislation last week, waiving the rule to allow Lloyd Austin to be in the cabinet as the head of the Pentagon, extension of the PPP, small business loan program under the pandemic, suspension of Medicare cuts that would be otherwise be automatic in the sequester. And now these are all small things. It's not the big stuff. It's not climate change legislation. It's not infrastructure. It's not immigration. But if the plan, the Republican plan, was to make everything as miserable as possible for the Biden administration, they wouldn't be doing this. They'd let the Medicare cuts go through. They'd let the small business go under, and they try to blame Biden for it, which was what they tried to do with Obama as much as they could. So that's the Republican side of the equation, I think you got to think about. Then the Democratic side, why isn't H.R. 1 on the floor? Why isn't the PRO Act on the floor? Why isn't the Equality Act on the floor? Why hasn't Schumer rushed those bills to the Senate floor, invited the filibuster, exposed the obstruction, and build up pressure for filibuster abolition or reform? Why isn't either side rushing to confrontation? And I think it's because both sides are worried that it won't be so easy to shift that blame and say the other guy is the one causing the obstruction. So everyone's kind of hanging on the edges of the arena, trying to see maybe we can get something bipartisan done here. Who's going to blink first? And that's leaving the Joe Manchin of the world some opportunity to say, hey, let's see what I can do to move the ball forward.
How much do you think this is Biden's leadership saying, you know, let's slow this process down, let's work where we can, because the idea is that we are trying to bring the country back together. We're trying to do some of the unity stuff.
I mean, I think Biden's genuinely conflicted. He's been a bipartisan figure his whole career, and I think he believes in his ability to, you know, mend the rifts, bring about consensus as much as possible, and depolarize the country. I think he very much wants to do that. But now, for the first time in his life, he's the actual president of the United States. And there's that inherent pressure, do something, deliver, go big. I think he wants to do both things. And we saw with the American Rescue Plan, push comes to shove, he'll go partisan and do the big thing. The question now is, on what things on the remaining to-do list does he have the 50 Democrats in hand so we can easily do that? Joe Manchin and others have said, wait a second, I'm not ready to go reconciliation on infrastructure. I want to see what I can get out of the Republicans. That, you know, everyone said, well, Biden has to force the issue, or Schumer has to force the issue. You bring something to the floor without 50, you're the one with egg on your face.
Exactly.
So and we just don't know how long the mansions of the Senate are going to insist they play out this string before pulling the plug.
Now, there are a lot of people who are saying, oh, we need to get rid of Manchin. We need to, you know, all of that talk. I'm sure you've heard it. But in a world where you get rid of Manchin, you have a Republican Senate.
I mean, there's no one else who can occupy that seat in West Virginia but Joe Manchin. And, you know, John Tester is not so easy to keep around in Montana. You know, Sherrod Brown's up in Ohio. That's going to be tricky to keep. And so there's this conflicting debate. What's it going to take for Democrats to have a good 2022? I mean, you know, midterms are often not good for the president's party in general. So what do you do to buck that trend? Deliver big? Well, you know, that there's an argument for that. But if you try to deliver big and you fail, that has downside risk. Maybe if you get that, you get some bipartisan deal. It's not as big as you would like, but it's something. You know, that can cut either way. I mean, the argument is, well, if you do something that's kind of milquetoast, kind of watered down, but nominally bipartisan, no one's going to care. They'll be mad at you that it wasn't big, and they'll blame you for it, not the Republicans. Possible. I don't deny that possibility. I think it's also possible that you get the 10 Republicans for, let's say you do $600 billion for infrastructure. It's not $2 trillion, it's $600 billion. That's sort of the low end of what Republicans say they would do. Democrats would grind their teeth that you settled for, you know, a quarter of a loaf. But how many Republicans will be mad that the Mitt Romney has got to call the shots and made Biden look good for delivering something, and then they stay home on election day? I mean, these Trumpers are mad at Liz Cheney for giving Biden a fist bump. How are they going to react if they give Biden a bona fide infrastructure win? So I say it's hard to know who's going to come out ahead in that circumstance. All I know is that Joe Manchin gets to call the tune right now, because you do need his vote whichever way you go.
Yeah, and the same thing with the two from Arizona. You need their vote as well. But you know, this is one of those things where I go, at some point, you've got to read the room and understand that if you don't get anything passed, 2022 is going to be a slaughter. So they do need to pass something by whatever means necessary. And if budget reconciliation is the path that you have to go, you got to make it big, because I think the only way Democrats hold on to power in 2022 is if people's lives are actually getting better, and the kind of optimism that we're seeing now about the economy and the direction of the country continues. That's the only way I see them holding on to the House and the Senate.
Well, there's a principle in negotiations called your BATNA. What is better? What's best alternative to a negotiated agreement?
Right.
So when you're going to have a negotiate with somebody, know in the back of your head, what can I do without this agreement? What's the best thing I can do without this agreement? In the American Rescue Plan, it was pretty clear. I can get $1.9 trillion without you. So why should I go down to $600 billion with you? Where's the upside for me? There is none. Hence, I'm not going to waste my time with you. With infrastructure, we don't know what the BATNA is. We don't know if Biden can get $2.3 trillion on his own. We don't know if Manchin will let him, or Sinema, or Mark Warner, or other, you know, relatively moderate, Angus King. These are all folks, a lot of folks who have said, we want pay-fors, we don't want deficit spending, and we're not sure about the kinds of taxes you want to increase. Manchin, you know, people think Manchin's this big populist. He's been a very business-friendly character for most of his career. And he's saying flat out, I think 28% corporate income tax is too high. You got to bring that down, get your pay for somewhere else. So we don't know exactly what they will let Biden do by himself, let alone the parliamentarian. What will the Senate parliamentarian allow in a reconciliation bill? So that leaves Biden's, you know, the firmness of the ground he stands on kind of shaky. And if you get to a point where the Manchins are really drawing a line in the sand saying, I'm going to make you be bipartisan, I'm not going to let you go do reconciliation on this, then your choice is not between $2.3 trillion and $600 billion. It might be between $600 billion and zero. And if it is there, that's a hard argument for Democrats to bring to the public in 2022. I could have got you $600 billion, but I got you zero because I wanted to fight a good fight. I think that's a hard argument.
No, you're so, right. And that's been one of the things that we've been talking.
Sorry, go on.
No, that's been one of the things that we've been talking about why Democrats haven't brought bills to the floor for the Republicans to filibuster, because it's kind of like a sacrificial lamb. If you bring it and you can't get the 50 votes, or they do filibuster it, it's one of those things that eventually just falls off and you don't get passed at all. So what bill do you then want to throw out to the wolves that ends up being sacrificed to tick off your base? It's a tough call.
I mean, right now, Republicans, to take them at their word, and maybe you don't, not everybody has to. I'm not saying they come with us with a reservoir of trust and goodwill, but they have said they would do upwards of, you know, close to $600 billion on physical infrastructure. They're not as keen on long-term care. They're not as keen on school construction, even though that is kind of physical. And the Democrat, if they want to get above that level, they have to really, really sell it. I mean, and I think Biden's trying here. I mean, and Biden in the State of the Union speech, or what technically not State of the Union, but his congressional address, trying to build that support around these broader planks. So the public is saying these are non-negotiable. The public is saying, I want that long-term care help. I'm trying to take care of my 80-year-old mother or father, and it's bleeding me dry, and it's making it hard for me to work. So to me, that is infrastructure, and I want that. If the desire is palpable, that strengthens Biden's hand. It strengthens the ability to say to Joe Manchin, you got to come with me on reconciliation for this if Republicans won't come on board, because the people are demanding it. Democrats can't assume you get one good poll number that kind of, you know, that kind of airily defines the bill, and that means that you got the public rock solid behind you on every line item. You got to work for that demand. And so if Democrats don't trust the Republicans on this, they have to make it easier for a Joe Manchin to cut loose by making the demand for the particulars of the bill very, very strong.
No, and that's one of the things that one of my negatives of his speech to Congress was that I thought there was too much in it. I think he should have stuck just to that infrastructure plan, should have just stuck to getting that pushed through and selling that. And then the call to action is, we need you to start. We need you to push. We need you to get out there and make us do what you want us to do. And kind of like the FDR style.
What's interesting to me about the speech, you know, most of the takes of the speech was how Biden went big. He made a proactive case for government. It wasn't Bill Clinton, the era of big government is over. There wasn't a lot of concessions in the speech itself. But at the same time, there wasn't a threat. He didn't say in the speech, work with the Republicans or I'll use reconciliation. Work with me or we're getting rid of the filibuster. He didn't do that. He was very nice to Republicans. He respected their counteroffer. He did not mention the price tag of the infrastructure bill, which by default means he wasn't drawing a red line there saying it has to be a certain level. He gave him a lot of latitude to compromise. And I think he did that because he's not sure he can go without them, number one. And then to your point, he mentioned all those other things because he didn't want to hear a bunch of nitpicking and second guessing. Why didn't you mention this? Why didn't you mention my thing? Why'd you leave that thing out? What are you trying to say there? So he's trying to keep everyone at bay. I mean, there are certain things like, you know, to be honest, you know, $15 minimum, PRO Act, these things do not have 50 right now. There is no reason to believe he can get those things through reconciliation. He mentioned them because he didn't want to get hammered for not mentioning them. And I think that's why that speech was spread a little bit thinly, so he wouldn't get attacked for leaving anything off of the table.
Yeah, I go back to, we needed that call to action to get people motivated, and not pointing out, hey, call this person or that person, but call your representatives, call your senators, and push them to move on the kind of infrastructure, like you said, caring for our most vulnerable and our seniors. That is going to be a huge thing in the coming years. I mean, it's a big thing now, but it's going to be even worse in the coming years. And if we don't start preparing for that now, crisis is coming.
You know, Reagan did that. You know, Reagan did, it wasn't the State of the Union, I don't recall, but he did give an address. I think it was an Oval Office address where he said, call your congresspeople. This is for one of the tax reform bills. Call your congressperson, put the pressure on them, and the switchboard was overflooded and the Congress, you know, came on board. There are other times when presidents have done that and the congresspeople get mad. Don't you pressure me. Don't you tell me what to do. I don't got to listen to your minions. So, I mean, it can work.
Your minions? You mean the voters?
That's right. That's right. So it can work. It can backfire. Biden wasn't ready to push that button. He was trying to be much nicer and to try to keep Republicans in the room. Maybe at some point he's gonna pull the plug and play that card. He wasn't ready to do it last week.
Now we find out that Mitch McConnell isn't ready to do anything on Biden's infrastructure bill. Came out today like it was some big news story. I'm reading this story like for the first time we're hearing that Mitch McConnell isn't going to be on board with Biden's infrastructure story. Maybe the $600 billion he was on board with. And this is the thing that the problem I have with our news media. I don't really think that was a breaking news story.
No, and let's remember here, McConnell's not irrelevant. But you don't need McConnell to get the 60. I mean, the person who's running point on this is Shelley Moore Capito of West Virginia. She's the person that Biden talked to. She's the one who put the plan together. She's the one that got 10 Republicans on board with, I mean, it's a thin counteroffer, but it's a nominal counteroffer. She did that, not McConnell. So, I mean, we'll see if she can keep those 10 on board if they're moving off of the initial bid and going higher and getting more specific. But if McConnell doesn't like it and Capito's got 9 others that are going to go with her, McConnell is completely irrelevant.
Going to be interesting to see how this plays out. Now, I didn't ask you what your position on the filibuster is. Are you a keep it or leave it guy?
I'm a keep it. I am nervous about what would happen if Democrats were in the minority. And I'm nervous about what would happen if you get rid of it, Democrats pass great big things, and then 4 years later, zoop, they're all gone. Because it's just as easy to repeal them as there is to pass them, and how destabilizing that could be. And I hear folks that tell me, well, Republicans, they don't want to pass anything anymore. So it's an advantage to those who just want to obstruct. And I remember the Bush years. They wanted to privatize Social Security. They wanted all that Paul Ryan stuff. And I think if you give them the opening to do it without a filibuster, they're going to take it next chance that they get.
Yeah.
So I think we got to – I mean, I'm not saying I got deep faith or high optimism, but there is the chance that the center of gravity of the country has shifted so much that you can pass some things with 10 Republicans. I at least want to give that a chance.
I'm with you.
Before we do something very dramatic.
I'm with you. But ultimately, I'm a 51 vote guy. I think ultimately you need to pass things. You need to get things done and let the voters decide. But we'll see where it goes. But Bill, I appreciate the time. Great piece. Thanks for taking time for us.
My pleasure. Take care.
Good stuff. Bill Scheer. Make sure you check out his Washington Monthly piece. We'll get links out on how you can do that. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
Hello, I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13. The American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. A union of over 1.4 million strong and growing, AFSCME is gaining improvements in the workplace all across America. And right here in the Commonwealth, more than 95,000 AFSCME members make Pennsylvania happen. Highways, libraries, hospitals, parks, offices, prisons, classrooms, museums, courtrooms. You'll find AFSCME members at work in all these places and many more.
I make Pennsylvania happen every day.
I make Pennsylvania happen every day.
Today's AFSCME members take on public service jobs as diverse as they are, not for the recognition, but for a better Pennsylvania. For more information, please visit our website at AFSCME13.org. Labor is changing, so is your labor union. We are AFSCME.
We are.